Chapter 9, The Shadow Across Sikkim. On the mantelpiece in the front room that was the Kazini's office, there stood a framed head-and-shoulders photograph of an elderly gentleman of decidedly military appearance. There may even have been a row of medals across his chest. It was not long before the Kazini informed me that this imposing personage was Field Marshal Mannerheim, the father of modern Finland, and that he was her uncle. It was in fact he who had brought her up, and throughout her life she had been greatly influenced by him. Later still, she confided to me that he was not her uncle, as she had been led to believe when she was young, but her father, and although she did not actually say so, it appears she was illegitimate. She always spoke of her supposed uncle or real father with great emotion, and seemed to have had a stronger feeling for him than for any other person in her life. She never spoke of her mother, but she often mentioned her sister, perhaps her half-sister, who lived in Edinburgh and with whom she was in regular correspondence. Her first husband she referred to only in passing and always in connection with their life in Burma. I never learned his given name, for she invariably spoke of him simply as Langford Ray, nor did I ever learn whether she was a divorcee or a widow when she had met the Kazi. There was, however, a son of about my own age called Roderick, who worked in a tea garden in Assam, and who must have been born when the Kazini was in her early or middle 20s. It was not easy to imagine the Kazini as a mother, either as a young woman or as the middle-aged woman she had become. There was very little that was motherly about her, though she was capable of showing genuine concern for those of whom she was fond. She once told me that she had no maternal feelings and was quite indifferent to her son, whom she had probably handed over to the care of a Burmese ayah soon after he was born. Just how indifferent she was to him became evident when news came that Roderick had been killed in a road accident in Assam. His death had not affected her in the slightest, she assured me the next time we met, in a tone and with an air that suggested the event was of absolutely no interest to her. She had displayed a similar lack of interest some months earlier, when Roderick came to see her in her new home. The Kazi received him kindly and was his usual hospitable self, but the Kazini took no more notice of him than if he had been the most casual of casual visitors. So far as I remember, he stayed at the Himalayan Hotel, but though he came several times to Chakung House, where I met him once, after the first visit, it seemed he came to meet the Kazi rather than to see his mother. What was more, during his short stay in the town, he somehow struck up a friendship with Joe Kan, whom he probably met in the lounge of the Himalayan Hotel, to which the scandal-mongering old man was a frequent visitor. The Kazini had refused to have anything to do with Joe Kan, for she knew, as I did, that during her 1950 visit to Kalimpong, he had spread scurrilous stories about herself and La Tsering, and she thought it best to see as little as possible of one who possessed such an evil tongue. Besides the photograph of the Field Marshal, there was also in the Kazini's office, and elsewhere in the house, another photograph in a silver frame. This was a studio portrait of a benign, gently smiling Kazi in traditional Sikkimese dress. It was the Kazini's favourite portrait of her husband, and it was she who had made him sit for it. She had made him sit for it not just out of wifely devotion, but also in her capacity as his publicity officer, and over the years she must have distributed hundreds of copies of it among journalists, editors of newspapers, and other possible supporters. Unlike the Kazini, the Kazi never spoke about his father, nor did he ever mention his mother. But there are several occasions on which he talked to me about his two uncles, Fodang Lama and Kangswar Dewan, who I gathered had been powerful and influential figures in the Sikkim of their day, and whom the Qazi evidently admired. He also talked to me about Chakung, his estate in western Sikkim, with its orange gardens and its cardamom fields, and he once took me there for a couple of days. There were only servants living in the roomy old timber mansion, and when showing me round, the Qazi directed my attention to the enormous brass talis, more than 2 feet in diameter, that hung on the wall. Members of the family would eat from one of these giant plates, which would be carried into the room, piled high with rice and meat. When they had eaten their fill, it would be taken back to the kitchen, where the servants and other dependents would eat what was left. Despite his feudal, aristocratic family background, the Qazi felt for the sufferings of the common people of Sikkim, regardless of whether they were of Tibetan, Lepcha, or Nepalese descent, and wanted to do what he could to improve their condition. This was one of the main reasons for his being in politics, the other reason being his hatred of the Maharaj Kumar, or Crown Prince, who now acted for his father, the Maharaja, and whom the Qazi was determined to finish off, as he once put it to me, with uncharacteristic ferocity. Before becoming friends with the Qazi and Qazini, I knew nothing about Sikkimese politics, even though I had been to Gangtok a number of times. But after becoming friends with them, I came to know quite a lot. But perhaps I should say I heard quite a lot about the politics of Sikkim, especially from the Qazini, for I had no real interest in the subject, and much of what I had heard was soon forgotten. Nonetheless, there were things I heard so often that I could not but remember them. Thus, I knew that the political party to which the Qazi originally belonged had collapsed, that a new party had been formed, and that the Qazi was president of this party, that the party was opposed to the rule of the Maharaj Kumar, and that it was campaigning for the establishment of a democratic Sikkim. I also knew that the Qazi had the support of the Nepalese, who were the majority community in Sikkim, his two powerful uncles having encouraged Nepalese immigration into the country, that there existed a political party that supported the Maharaj Kumar, that the little Himalayan kingdom was a protectorate of India, and that the biggest player in the messy game of Sikkimese politics was the government of India. The Qazini was much more aware of the Indian dimension to Sikkimese politics than was the Qazi, even though it was he who went to Delhi for the purpose of explaining his party's position to officials in the Department of External Affairs. Besides being widely travelled, during her years in the Indian capital, she had moved in political and diplomatic circles, had met many people, and was remarkably well informed. Like quite a few British officials in the days of the Raj, she preferred Muslims to Hindus, and for a time had been married to a Muslim, Dr. Khan. They were married according to Islamic law, she told me, but since he would not agree to have a civil ceremony as well, she had refused to consummate the marriage and had left him. She was also decidedly pro-Pakistan, which meant she was correspondingly anti-Hindustan, and she admired the Socialist Party and its leaders much more than she admired the Congress Party and its leaders. Mahatma Gandhi she disliked, and in this connection she had a story to tell. She had once attended one of the Mahatma's prayer meetings in the grounds of Birla House, where he was subsequently assassinated, and had found herself sitting directly behind him. As he listened to the scripture readings, she had studied him closely, eventually saying to herself, "No, I don't like you." Thereupon the old man had turned round and said, with a smile, "You don't like me, do you, madame?" She had been utterly astonished and had not known what to say. It was as though he had read or felt her thoughts as she studied him. The Cazzini told the story very well, wrinkling up her nose and shaking her head as she described how she had felt towards the Mahatma, for she was an excellent raconteur and could be very entertaining. She was also an excellent mimic, and I well remember her hilarious imitation of Pandit Nehru, the Prime Minister, absent-mindedly picking his nose as he presided over a public function. All things considered, it was not surprising that at their first meeting the Qazi should have been quite dazzled by the mature charms of the lively, articulate woman of the world, the like of whom he had not encountered before, though he was not so dazzled that he could not see that she could be of great help to him in his political career. In the event, she proved to be a greater help to him than he could possibly have imagined. Besides being his public relations officer, she drafted his petitions and proclamations, did all his typing, and very soon was advising him and his colleagues on policy and tactics, one of the Qazi's favourite English words, and giving them the benefit of her legal knowledge and her intellectual acumen. In short, she threw herself wholeheartedly into what she had first termed, rather disparagingly, Qazi's politics, and identified herself with them to such an extent that she became, over the years, as great a force within the party as the Qazi, and at times a greater one. She was especially popular with the younger party activists, who were often at the house, for they liked the intemperate manner in which she denounced the Maharaj Kumar as a dictator and a tyrant, and called upon them to overthrow his corrupt and oppressive regime. Like the Qazi, she spoke the language of democracy and human rights, but it was not a language that was natural to her. Unlike the Qazi, she had no real feeling for the sufferings of the common people of Sikkim. She was very much the grande dame, and had she dazzled the Maharaj Kumar with her mature charms and married him instead of the Qazi, an unlikely event in view of the disparity between their ages, she would no doubt have thrown herself into his politics no less wholeheartedly than she had thrown herself into the Qazi's, and probably with greater satisfaction. Yet here she was in Chakung House, Kalimpong, and not in the palace, Gangtok, and denouncing not Qazi Lendrup Dorje as a dangerous revolutionary, but the Maharaj Kumar as a power-crazed dictator. She denounced him as a dictator so often, and to my mind, so unfairly, that one day I asked her how many political prisoners there were in Sikkim. This took the wind out of her sails, for she was obliged to admit that there were no political prisoners in Sikkim. On another occasion, the Qazi and I accused her of being a far bigger dictator than the Maharaj Kumar. We spoke laughingly, but she could see there was truth in the accusation all the same, and joined in the laughter, even though it was at her expense. Although she worked tirelessly for the Qazi and was such a force within his party, the Qazini did not appear openly on the stage of Sikkimese politics. She worked behind the scenes, preferring to help to shape the script rather than to play any of the parts, even an important one. Letters over her signature did, however, appear frequently in the correspondence columns of the English language Calcutta dailies. The letters were written in a lively, entertaining style, and often ridiculed the Maharaj Kumar's plans for the benefit of his country, and even the unfortunate ruler himself. The Maharaj Kumar felt this ridicule keenly, and whenever I was in Gangtok and staying at the palace guest house, he would complain to me bitterly about the Qazini's letters as soon as we met. He knew I could do nothing about them, nor did he expect me to, but was simply giving vent to his feelings. I did, however, once manage to convince the Qazini that a certain letter was libelous and should not be published. The Maharaj Kumar also once complained to me about the behaviour of Appa Pant, the political officer, a Chitpavan Brahmin from Pune and a staunch Hindu. Pant had actually had the audacity to install, in the grounds of the residency, a giant image of Hanuman, the Hindu monkey god. I already knew this, Pant having taken me to see the image the last time I stayed with him. The image faced north, he had explained, in the direction of Tibet, and the god's club was grounded, not shouldered, as a sign that India's intentions towards China were peaceful. But the Maharaj Kumar was not concerned with how Hanuman bore his weapon. What concerned him and excited his indignation was the fact that at a certain hour of the day, the giant image's shadow fell across the palace. "Some people will think that it's just foolish superstition," he told me. "But Pant believes in these things, and he knows that we believe." I could not say that I believed in them, but I knew that India's shadow had fallen across Sikkim, and that in the eyes of the Maharaj Kumar, the shadow across the palace symbolized that bigger and darker shadow. Independent India was in expansionist mood, despite Hanuman's grounded club, and I very much feared that sooner or later, by one means or another, Sikkim would be absorbed into the Indian Union and lose its separate identity. I also feared that the Kazi and Kazini were unwittingly helping to facilitate this process with their activities. For his part, the Maharaj Kumar was bent on preserving Sikkim as a Buddhist kingdom with its own cultural and religious tradition and its own political structures. And in this, he had my full sympathy. Just as the Maharaj Kumar would complain to me about the Kazini's letters to the press had only appeared since our last meeting, so whenever I returned from Gangtok, she would always want to know if I had met the Maharaj Kumar, and if I had met him, what had passed between us. She was not interested in our discussions about Buddhist activities in Sikkim, or the revival of the country's traditional arts and crafts. All she wanted to know was whether the Maharaj Kumar had talked about her, and in particular, whether he complained about her letters to the press. For if he complained, it would mean that their purpose, which was to hurt him, had been fulfilled. The Sikkimese prince and the European lady, indeed, seemed to be obsessed with each other, even though they had never really met, as the Kazini was persona non grata at the palace, and as the Maharaj Kumar, though he sometimes came to see me at the Vihara, never called at Chakum House. Even the Kazi sometimes felt that the Kazini's preoccupation with the Maharaj Kumar's misdeeds, real or imagined, was excessive. Hers was a character of the obsessional type, and during the time I was in regular contact with her, it was with politics, in the sense of party politics and political intrigue and gossip, that she was obsessed, and apparently always had been. Outside politics, she had, in fact, few interests. She was hardly ever seen in the bazaar, had no real social life, and seldom relaxed. If she did relax, it was either over a tumba or bamboo beaker of home-brewed millet beer, or over a book from her personal library. This little collection, which she had brought with her from Delhi, consisted mainly of political biographies and diplomatic memoirs. Her favourite author was Daniel Vary, a retired Italian diplomat, whose biography of the Dowager Empress of China she particularly praised. The Kazini's obsession with politics, especially Sikkimese party politics, did her little good. Though she retained her robust appearance and her upright, almost regal bearing, it was an obsession that not only made her restless and anxious, but soured her temper and frayed her nerves. Each time I returned from one of my preaching tours, which generally lasted 4 or 5 months, I could not help noticing that despite the powder and paint, her features were more drawn and haggard than when I had last seen her. She was always glad, even relieved, to see me, and although we had corresponded regularly during my tour, she lost no time in telling me what had been happening in my absence, with special reference to the Maharaj Kumar's misdeeds and the Kazi's reluctance to follow her advice. There had already been differences between her and the Kazi with regard to what he and his party should do next, whether in the way of responding to events or precipitating them. And in course of time, these differences became more pronounced and led to some angry exchanges. If the Kazini was a sledgehammer, the Kazi was a rock on which she often found it difficult to make an impression, which meant she was often an extremely frustrated woman. The frustration showed itself in a constant nervous drumming with her fingers on the table, or on the arm of her chair, and in the fact that she was irritable and impatient with her husband in minor domestic matters. Occasionally, the frustration reached such a point that there would be an explosion. A stream of violent reproaches and angry recriminations would be directed at the Qazi, and he would find it impossible to reason with the Qazini or to calm her down. When this happened, he would send a servant down to the Vihara with a verbal message requesting me to come up as soon as it was convenient for me to do so. I could always tell something was amiss from the way the servant spoke, and would therefore drop whatever I was doing and go up straight away. On my arrival at Chakung House, the Qazi would disappear into the kitchen to order tea for me, leaving me alone with the Qazini, whom I once found prostrate on the drawing-room carpet, as though she had been biting it in her rage. On this occasion, as on the others when I had been sent for, she at once launched into a litany of complaints against the Qazi, the chief of which were that he never heeded her advice, that he listened too much to other people, and that he was incapable of making up his mind about anything. As I usually did, I listened to her for a while without saying very much, allowing her anger to exhaust itself. Then gradually led the conversation away from the subject of the Qazi and into more peaceful and productive channels. Within little more than an hour, she was her normal self. There were no traces of tears to be wiped away, for unlike other women, she did not cry when she was frustrated, which was probably a mistake on her part, for the Qazi was a soft-hearted man, and tears might have had a greater effect on him than the tenth repetition of her point of view. Be that as it may, now that she was herself again, the Qazi reappeared. A smiling servant brought in tumblers for him and the Qazini, and more tea for me, and the three of us spent a pleasant hour together. The Qazini probably reminisced about her glamorous life in Delhi, and may even have referred to the Maharaj Kumar without too much acrimony. Had the episode taken place in the summer of 1962, we must have talked about the Maharaj Kumar's forthcoming marriage to Hope Cook, a young American socialite whom he had met in Darjeeling 2 years previously. I was not interested in the marriage itself, which was attracting international attention and would no doubt be a colourful affair, but only in the fact that hundreds of pigs, chickens and other living creatures were to be killed for the wedding feast. Since Sikkim was a Buddhist kingdom, with a Chogyal or Dharmaraja for its ruler, this seemed quite inappropriate, and I therefore wrote to the Maharaj Kumar protesting against the slaughter, as well as against the amount of alcohol that had been ordered. He replied at some length, maintaining that the number of animals to be killed and the amount of alcohol that would be consumed had been greatly exaggerated, and that age-old customs and traditions had to be kept up. This did not satisfy me, and the correspondence continued. While it was still in progress, I happened to run into Princess Pema Tsedyan in the high street. "Why are you writing these dreadful letters to my brother?" she demanded, half angrily and half tearfully. The Maharaj Kumar himself took my criticism in good part, and it was not long before I was having tea at the palace with him and his new wife. What the Qazini wanted to know when I returned from Gangtok this time was not whether the Maharaj Kumar had talked about her and her letters, but whether I thought he and Hope Cook were in love, for it was widely believed that he had married her for political reasons. He was obviously very much in love with the lady, I told her, but whether she was in love with him, I was quite unable to say.